It's another beautiful Sunday afternoon here in the Paris of the South. Welcome to Wordplay, your program by and about poets and creative writers, their craft and ideas. Today we have a really, really special program, one featuring one of my favorite poets of my generation, Bill Matthews.
Hey, Jeff, it's going to be a good day. I'm excited for it. Today is the William Matthews is my dad, and he died 10 years ago.
Yeah.
He died 10 years ago today.
Today?
Actually, yesterday.
Tomorrow. Tomorrow.
And today is his birthday.
And today is his birthday. So this is a special birthday show for Bill.
Yeah, a couple anniversaries.
Yeah.
It's a treat to know that Robert Morgan's in town, that somebody like you who worked with him back in the day and UNC, so many different connections. Let's just jump in. What are we going to start with?
We're going to start with some readings from a cassette tape that your dad did, Days Beyond Recall. This came out, I don't see a date on it. Do you know when it came out, Sebastian?
Yeah, I think in the early 80s.
Early 80s.
And let's, before we start, I'll put a little music on, and then we'll go from the music into the poetry.
Okay, sounds great.
Great. This is Cannonball Adderley doing Bill Evans's Waltz for Debbie.
Housework. How precise it seems, like a dollhouse. And look, the tiniest socks ever knit are crumpled on a chair in your bedroom. And how still, like the air inside a church or basketball. How you could have lived your boyhood here is hard to know, unless the blandishing lilacs and slant rain stippling the lamplight sustained you, and the friendship of dogs, and the secrecy that flourishes in vacant lots. For who would sleep like a cat in a drawer in this house memory is always dusting, unless it be you? I'd hear you on the stairs, an avalanche of sneakers, and then the sift of your absence, and then I'd begin to rub the house like a lantern until you came back and grew up to be me, wondering how to sleep in this lie of memory unless it be made clean. This poem called Living Among the Dead bears an epigraph from the French poet Paul Éluard, who wrote, "There is another world, but it is in this one." First there were those who died before I was born. It was as if they had just left, and their shadows would slip out after them under the door so recently closed the air and its path was still swirling to rest. Some of the furniture came from them, I was told, and one day I opened two chests of drawers to learn what the dead kept. But it was when I learned to read that I began always to live among the dead. I remember Rapunzel, the improved animals in the just-so stories, and a flock of birds that saved themselves from a hunter by flying in place in the shape of a tree, their wings imitating the whisk of wind in the leaves. My sons and I are like some wine the dead have already bottled. They wish us well, but there is nothing they can do for us. Sebastian cries in his sleep. I bring him into my bed, talk to him, rub his back. To help his sons live easily among the dead is a father's great work. Now Sebastian drifts, soon he'll sleep. We can almost hear the dead breathing. They sound like water under a ship at sea. To love the dead is easy. They are final, perfect, but to love a child is sometimes to fail at love while the dead look on with their abstract sorrow. To love a child is to turn away from the patient dead. It is to sleep carefully in case he cries. Later, when my sons are grown among their own dead, I can dive easily into sleep and loll among the coral of my dreams growing on themselves, until at the end I almost never dream of anyone except my sons, who is still alive. Moving again. At night the mountains look like huge dim hens. In a few geological eras, new mountains may shatter the Earth's shell and poke up like stone wings. Each part must serve for a whole. I bring my sons to the base of the foothills, and we go up. From a scruff of ponderosa pines, we startle gaudy swerves of magpies that settle in our rising wake. Then there's a blooming prickly pear. "Jesus, Dad, what's that?" Willie asks. "It's like a yellow tulip grafted to a cactus. It's a beautiful wound the cactus puts out to bear fruit and be healed. If I lived with my sons all year, I'd be less sentimental about them." We go up to the mesa top and look down at our new hometown. The thin air warps in the melting light like the aura before a migraine. The boys are tired. A tiny magpie fluffs into a pine far below, and farther down in the valley of child support and lights, people are opening drawers. One of them finds a yellowing patch of newsprint with a phone number penciled on it, from Illinois, from before they moved, before Nikki was born. Memory is our root system. "Verna," he says to himself, because his wife's in another room, "whose number do you suppose this is?" New. The long path sap sludges up through an iris. Is it new each spring? And what would an iris care for novelty? Urgent in tatters, it wants to wrest what routine it can from the ceaseless shifts of weather, from the scrounge it feeds on to grow beautiful and bigger. Last week, the space about to be rumpled by iris petals was only air through which a rabbit leapt, a volley of heartbeats hardly contained by fur, and then the clay-colored spaniel in pursuit, and the effortless air rejoining itself whole. My love of the lioness. When I think of her shaggy ease, her stolid, redolent musk, a tongue in my stomach talks. And she unfurls to her feet and paces, and her tail waves like a snake growing out of a ship, and her toenails click in her cage. How can I know what I look at? Me, with my muscles that knot like vowels from another language. Me, rationalized and hairless, a swimmer who shaves his body for the race. Me, the maker of false comparisons, the lighthouse that never looks in, I only spin. And she subsides the drizzle and mist of a fountain that turns itself off for the night. And I know, watching her sink into herself, I know I've locked her up to symbolize. Her feet, as fat as my knees, pacing, turning that wheel in her shoulder at either end of the cage. This poem, which is called Becoming a Woman, bears an epigraph from a French author named Jean-Philippe Boutron, which goes as follows. A man writing a poem is speaking to a woman inside him. That explains the common notion that a male poet is lecherous, homosexual, or both. Why not say it this way? He wants to be whatever is other, a frog's tongue, an island formed by a volcano, the opposite sex, someone who loves him, the universe. You will look in vain in card catalogs for the works of Jean-Philippe Boutron, since he is an author whom I made up in order to give him that statement to write. All morning I watch how my hands love each other by releasing something else. I'm the only one who can forgive me for those I have loved. I'm becoming a woman. I lie all afternoon in dry grass to hear the insects whir around me like fish circling a wreck. My time isn't my own. Soon you'll be coming home. What's wrong with me? I can't explain. I feel like a moon in a sack, a bass bent against the current like a leer, a dog with a cold rope. Where have you been? A bowl of thirst, some words. Listen, big boy, you know those love poems of yours? The only places I could live in them are silences. I leave a light on in the bathroom for the moth. You give me your body, that arc with one of every kind of animal. I want to weep, as if sleeping meant entering an onion. I grow thicker. I will be my coach and my destination. Search party. I wondered if the others felt as heroic and as safe. My unmangled family slept while I slid uncertain feet ahead behind my flashlight's beam. Stones, thick roots as twisted as a ruined body. What did I fear? I hoped my batteries had 8 more lives than the lost child. I feared I'd find something. Reader, by now you must be sure you know just where we are. Deep in symbolic woods, irony, self-accusation, someone else's suffering, the search is that of art. You're wrong, though it's an intelligent mistake. There was a real lost child. I don't want to swaddle it in metaphor. I'm just a journalist who can't believe in objectivity. I'm in these poems because I'm in my life, but I digress. A man 4 volunteers to the left of me made the discovery. We circled in like waves returning to the parent shock. You've read this far. You might as well have been there too. Your eyes accuse me of false chase. Come off it. You're the one who thought it wouldn't matter what we found. Though we came with lights and tongues thick in our heads, the issue was a human life. The child was still alive. Admit you're glad. Talking to the moon. A defeated politician is in circulation again, as we say of coins, and his mouth is full of words. His words have all been handled smooth. They'd shrink like lozenges, except some sweat from everyone whose head them is on them. He could be you. Why don't you support him? But some people hoard words. The year the lake froze all the way across, a sentence might begin, and then nod, sleepy in a hot kitchen. The words are a spell to make the lake freeze again. The sentence never ends. Rick used to love to tell how he and Joanne would creep into her parents' house after dates, and under the dining room table he'd eat her out, he'd say, as if she were an egg and he a weasel. His eyes gleamed with grief. He wanted her back. He told the story again and again. The full moon fills the canyon with pale cream. My huge dog leans against my knee so hard he'd fall over if I moved. Soon he'll go to sleep under the juniper. The other morning, a finch landed on his back while he slept. He unfurled one eye. A finch. I tell him his name. He goes to the juniper and sleeps. The moon's so bright, it has no features, button with no holes. I've nothing to say to the moon. Still, I want to talk. I want words to be magic, some secret I have the way I have my body, so long as it lasts. I want words to be food, enough for us all to eat. The mild stars shine. The words I want are sewing my body to sleep, the no news that is good news, blood tying and untying its knots. Stone. The creek has made its bed and wants to lie in it. That's why spring is terrifying. Water rises like the bloated drowned against the ice. In the churn, stones are born stunned. And at night, the house rising like a cliff of fire, there were the trees, mobiles of shale, and the grass like a field of tiny gravestones growing wild. And the moon, a stone fruit hoping to be opened, its 28 sections of stolen light flying home. In the stream bed, a stone shaped by water surge. It looks like the ankle bone of a lost species grown too graceful. Evolution makes us sleek for the long flight. Finally, our common life breaks open, a pod releasing its stone peas, and the earth bears in a few places, a few wrinkles in our shapes for a few million years.
Here's Bill Matthews.
I'm going to begin one way or another by reading a poem whose title is stolen, as a number of titles of my poems are, from musical compositions, often jazz and blues. The relationship between the source from which the title has been stolen and the poem to which I have spirited the stolen title is usually emotional. There's no other obvious connection between the two. This poem, for example, is called Mood Indigo, title stolen, of course, from Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. But it involves a woman in the rural American Midwest on a farm. Ellington was probably the most relentlessly urban American ever. Mood Indigo. Oh, one thing to say before I read this poem. There's a list of names of radio shows
in this poem. This poem seems to take place in before television had done whatever it's done to American life. And when on late Sunday afternoons, everyone is bored on Sundays, is a loose translation of a French proverb, and Sunday afternoons are the worst. And in America, late on Sunday afternoons, the adults were dealing with their boredom however they did, but when I was a child, you could listen to a series of radio dramas, which were lurid, thrilling, sentimental, sensational, and designed for dreamy children, such as the a young woman in this poem is. Mood Indigo. From the porch, from the hayrick, where her prickled brothers hid and chortled and slurped into their young pink lungs the ash-blonde, dusty air that lay above the bales like low clouds, and from the squeak and suck of the well pump, and from the glove of rusted and blood on her hand, from the dress parade of clothes in her moth-proofed closet, from her tiny Philco, a kind of radio, from her tiny Philco with its cracked speaker, and Sunday Litany, Nick Carter, The Shadow, The Green Hornet, Sky King, from the loosening bud of her body, from hunger, as they say, and from reading, from the finger she used to dial her own number, from the dark loam of the harrowed fields and from the very sky, it came from everywhere. Which is to say, it was always there and that it came from nowhere. It evaporated with the dew, and at dusk when dark spread in the sky like water in a blotter, it spread too. But it came back and curdled with milk and stung with nettles. It was in the bleat of the lamb, the way a clapper is in a bell, and in the raucous, scratchy gossip of the crows. It walked with her to school and lay with her to sleep, and at last she was well pleased. If she were to sew, she would prick her finger with it. If she were to bake, it would linger in the kitchen like an odor snarled in the deepest folds of childhood. It became her dead pet, her lost love, the baby sister blue and dead at birth, the chill headwaters of the river that purled and meandered and ran until it issued into her as into a sea. And then she was its and it was wholly hers. She kept to her room, as we learned to say, but now and then she'd come down and pass through the kitchen and the screen door would close behind her with no more sound than an envelope being sealed. And she'd walk for hours in the fields like a lithe blue rain and end up in the barn and one of us would go and bring her in. And the last of our poems this evening is, this book has in it four, there are a number of poems which are about, in the way the last three poems are about, the cost of keeping us civil order. And there are a bunch of other poems in the book which are not frankly interested, though they may be secretly interested in that question, but are about people uninterested in that at all. And that one of the heroes of these poems, there are four of these poems which have the same hero. It's a great American jazz bassist and composer, Charles Mingus. I think of those four poems as being in some way sort of the compass directions of the book against which everything else is mapped. Mingus appears in various disguises or parts of his life. All these disguises are true. He disguises himself each time and looks completely different from the last time. And one of them is about... I might as well be looking for this while I offer you this bit of amiable chatter. It's right about in here. One of them is about Mingus after his death, when he's consigned to our ability to remember him and to be, enabled and moved and terrified and pleased by his music. He's probably, after Ellington, the second greatest of the jazz composers we've had in that tradition, unless Thelonious Monk is, but to my ear, Mingus is the one. He was, as the poem will tell you, an enormous man physically. An important part of his social being. The poem begins by imagining the size of the man, something that incredibly important in his life and absolutely inconsequential the minute he's dead. The poem's called Mingus in Diaspora. You could say, I suppose, that he ate his way out, like the prisoner who starts a tunnel with a spoon. Or you could say he was one in whom nothing was lost, who took it all in, or that he was big as a bus. He would say, and he did, in one of those blurred melismatic slaloms his sentences ran, for all the music was in his speech. Swift switches of tempo, stop time, double time, he could talk in 6/8. The parodists fear that he's lost his own voice, the durable voice that grates the parodist crazy. I just ruined my body. And there, Exhibit A, it stood, that Parthenon of fat. The tenant voice lifted, as we say, since words are a weight, and music. Silence is lighter than air, and rises like smoke from a chimney drawn by a child, and curlicues, slackening, paling, and then altogether gone. The edge of the paper in that child's drawing stands for the unsayable, the air to which air returns as we, the story goes, return to dust. Religious stories are rich in symmetry. Just now the air is rising from us to be whole, and the dust falling from us to be with its parents. And we stand in the amiable ruins of our flesh, grateful to those who make music or credible speech. Okay.
Charlie Mingus, Memories of Youth.
Yeah, nice. And the music we had at break was by Duke Ellington, of course. That was Mood Indigo. And we've been listening to a live recording of Bill Matthews reading at the Poets' House, July 21st, 1992.
It's the one in Ireland. I think he read there with Billy Collins that night.
That's right. Billy Collins introduced him. Yes, right. That was Billy Collins' voice we heard just at the beginning.
Well, you're listening to WPVM, and thanks for listening. Jeff, thank you so much for doing the show with me. It's been a real treat.
Oh, it has been a treat. It was great to hear Bill's voice again.
And just see you guys next week.
That's Wordplay for this week.
WPVM LP Asheville, broadcast service of the Mountain Area Information Network.